In the brotherhood of man, you can distinguish between apostles and disciples. This has nothing whatsoever to do with the Urantia Brotherhood. When you find a human being who is trying to love his fellow men with a fatherly affection, this is the way Jesus loved men, then you have found an apostle. I don't even care whether he's a Christian or not. This is an apostle. When you find a human being who has learned to love his fellow men with a fraternal affection, quite an achievement, you have found a disciple, Christian or otherwise. This is the way you distinguish between a disciple and an apostle. It is the difference between brotherly love and fatherly love. A brother would be fair to another brother, would he not? But a father would take pleasure in retaliating good for evil. This is the difference between fatherly love and brotherly love. When Lucifer rebelled, his father did not contend with him. Neither did his father Michael prevent his older brother Gabriel from going down and combating Lucifer's manifesto. It's one thing for a brother to contend with a brother, but a father would hardly contend with a son. The papers make very clear the distinction between fatherly love and brotherly love. And this is the distinction between an apostle and a disciple as Jesus made that distinction. This is not a distinction which the Urantia Brotherhood can ever make as an official organization. This is something which men and women will do individually, personally, and in their own hearts. There is a distinction, but I don't think it has anything whatsoever to do with the Urantia Brotherhood. It has to do with the kingdom of heaven and the brotherhood of man, which is something altogether larger. Does anyone else have an opinion on this point? You know, when he said to the 12, if you will love men as I have loved you, these will be your credentials. And Jesus loved not as a brother, he loved as a father. What do you think about that idea? You know, the time has come to be sophisticated in the true sense of the word, not in the sophomoric sense. These papers encourage me to have the courage of post-sophomoric sophistication. Papers make this statement concerning themselves. No revelation short of the attainment of the Universal Father can ever be complete. All other celestial ministrations are no more than partial, transient, and practically adapted to local conditions in time and space. While such admissions as this may possibly detract from the immediate force and authority of all revelations, the time has arrived on Urantia when it is advisable to make such frank statements, even at the risk of weakening the future influence and authority of this the most recent of the revelations of truth to the mortal races of Urantia. This big blue book does not claim infallibility. Let's see if I can find another quote in here. Irreligions of Urantia, they've just taken inventory of every religion now in existence, to wit, there are 11 of them: Hinduism, the Hebrew religion, Buddhism, the Confucian teachings, the Taoist beliefs, Zoroastrianism, Shinto, Jainism, Christianity, Islam, and Sikhism. The many religions of Urantia are all good to the extent that they bring man to God and bring the realization of the Father to man. It is a fallacy for any group of religionists to conceive of their creed as the truth. Such attitudes bespeak more of theological arrogance than certainty of faith. There is not a Urantia religion that could not profitably study and assimilate the best of the truths contained in every other faith. Religionists would do better to borrow the best in their neighbor's living spiritual faith rather than to denounce the worst in their lingering superstitions and outworn rituals. Page 1012, paragraph 5. All these religions have arisen as a result of man's variable intellectual response to his identical spiritual leading. They can never hope to attain a uniformity of creeds, dogmas, and rituals. These are intellectual, but they can, and someday will, realize a unity in true worship of the Father of all. For this is spiritual, and it is forever true. In the Spirit, all men are equal. You know, that's a new charter of liberty in religious thinking on this world. It's a little difficult. It's going to hurt the immediate spread of the Urantia book and the immediate spread of the Urantia Brotherhood, because it deprives any thinking Urantian of the tremendous stimulus to action which we could have if we believed that we were the heron folk, the cosmic heron folk, God's chosen people. You know, you either have the blue book or you don't make it. Now that's par for the theological course today, isn't it? You're dipped? Fine. You can make it. And if you're sprinkled, you can't. Jehovah's Witnesses testify to this point. But the time has come to be honest. The time has come to be sophisticated in the larger sense of the word. The time has come to have a religion which can appeal to thinking, rational people. If this book said that you have to have the blue book and wear three concentric circles in your lapel and go through this, that, or the other thing All I can say is, dear comrades, I should not be with you today. Any more than Thomas would have stuck it out with Jesus if Jesus' gospel had been phony. Thomas stuck with Jesus because it smelled fact and truth. And I have a great deal of empathy for Brother Thomas in this respect. These papers do not ask me to do anything which creates in me intellectual nausea. And this has got to be true. Elsewhere, that's an awfully good question that someone asked. I'm grateful to them. That statement on sincerity. Define the keys of the kingdom as sincerity, sincerity, and more sincerity. If you are sincere in your worship of God, it doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference what you call Him. Amitabha, Tao, Kuan Yin, Baldur, Woden, what difference the name you apply? You can call Him Shiva, Vishnu, Kali, Allah, Yahweh, in His modern corrupt form, Jehovah. The Hebrews had many names for God. El Elyon, Adonai, El Shaddai, as well as Yahweh and Elohim. What difference the name, if you're sincere? And if you have courage, you act on your sincerity. And since you're unwise and have free will, it's a cinch you will make mistakes. But if you're sincere and have courage, you'll face your mistakes, learn from them, and improve. And here we have the essential ingredients of experiential progress. I hope the Urantia Brotherhood never commissions either apostles or disciples. I'm sure that they will, in part, do both, because they cannot escape the mores of the middle of the 20th century. Is this bad? Yep, that's evil. Do we compromise with evil? Yep, we do. How can I be sure that we do? Jesus did. Jesus could not escape the mores of the first century A.D. There are two bad concepts which Jesus eventually compromised on. Number one, the Messiah. Please remember the word Messiah and the word Christ originally had exactly the same meaning. They insisted He was the Christ. He insisted He was not. Finally, He gave up. He said, all right, I am the Christ, but not the kind of a Messiah, not the kind of a deliverer you're looking for. He couldn't change the thinking of the 12. Compromise number two. They insisted on calling it the Kingdom of Heaven. He could not get them not to call it the Kingdom of Heaven. And so finally He went along with the idea of the Kingdom of Heaven. The term Christ, the concept Kingdom of Heaven, was dictated to Jesus by the 12 and the disciples. He could not escape the grooved thinking of the first century A.D. Neither will the Brotherhood wholly escape the thinking grooves which are characteristic of the middle of the 20th century A.D. For heaven's sakes. I knew it was ministering spirits, but I thought it was kind of him.
Lucky you brought Ruth back, Bill.
Yeah. We had Ruth on Paradise, but we brought her back again. Yes, at the bottom of page 435. The keys of the kingdom of heaven are sincerity, more sincerity, and more sincerity. All men have these keys. Men use them. Advance in spirit status by decisions, by more decisions, and by more decisions. They're not peculiar to rebellion isolated planets. The Most Highs can intervene at any time in the affairs of the inhabited worlds, interposing their superior wisdom. This is a check which the constellation level exercises on the whole Verandadec administration, at least in this local universe. It seems to me that Michael, in planning this universe, has planned boldly. And the authors of the paper say that no creature has any right to criticize the plans of a creator. I think he has planned Lenanandex, who are extremely brilliant, who have a tremendous range of freedom of choice. And as the papers point out, Nebadon, with the possible exception of two other local universes, has had more Lenanandek troubles than any other local universe in Arvanta. And then they go on to say, sure, during your growth period, you have these troubles. Later on, when you're settled and light in life, you cash in on the versatility and ingenuity of this Lenanandek group. The Melchizedeks are very versatile, extremely ingenious, occasionally make mistakes, never go into rebellion, but sometimes they err in administrative judgment and are overruled. Now it seems to me that Michael, in making these plans for these two orders, has set up as a balance the Verandadeks, who impress me as being the quintessence of stability in the local universe. The papers do not extol the Verandadeks in terms of versatility, imagination, adaptability, but they extol them in terms of stability and long-range wisdom and judgment. I'm speculating as to the checks and balances in Michael's creative plan. Having taken chances with two orders, he built a lot of stability into the intervening order. Shall we bust up for lunch? Make it too easy. There was James and Judas Alpheus, whom Jesus called apostles.
Yeah, two talents.
They were apostles of single talents.
Well, they didn't go bury it.
I understand. They were the least of the apostles. They felt cheerful about it. And they were very proud to be numbered among such mighty men. The only real definition I know of the difference between an apostle and a disciple is the quality of love. All must love. But to the multitude Jesus presented the ideal of the golden rule, to love men as you love yourself. But to the teachers he presented a higher ethic, to attempt to love man as God loves man, and that's a fatherly love. To return good for evil, very difficult for a brother, very easy for a father, and I appeal to any parent in this room for validation. Any parent knows the truth of that statement. This is a copper-covered, double-riveted, lead pipe cinch to forgive your children. isn't it? This is not so easy with your fellow men. We've come a long ways from the Trinity of Trinities. We're getting down into what I call the guts of religion. How about that, Marie? Feel more at home?
I feel more at home every minute.
You see, we can not only play on the piccolo, but we attempt the trombone. I'll tell you where I have a little bit of trouble in the forum and in a Urantia society. I happen to be a pretty religious guy, but I'm a little bit shy on this subject. I can talk about theology, but there are things that boil around inside my gut that are so private that I can't talk about them. They're intimate. It's like discussing one's sex life in public, if you know what I mean. And I just am not the kind of a religious extrovert that can wear sackcloth and ashes and discuss the affairs of my soul. So, please, this is my private life. I have it, and we'll nibble around the edges of it. But I can't discuss it with the same intellectual candor and freedom that I can the metaphysics and the philosophy of the papers. I have very strong feelings about God, but I haven't got any words for it. You know what I mean? In other words, I'm never going to be a good preacher, because a preacher can yak about this and I can't. In terms of my personal, intimate religious life, I'm an introvert. I'm embarrassed. It's very real, very precious, very growing. But I can't talk about it. It's an intimate thing. I'll tell you, it's there, though. I can yak like crazy about the philosophy of these papers. Question. Let not your animal slothfulness and indolence tempt the seraphim of your supervision to lead your footsteps into devious paths for the good of your soul. Paul, if it really means what it says, that the greatest tribulation in all the universe is never to experience tribulation, do you suppose that our seraphic supervisors would knowingly subject us to this greatest tribulation? No. Here's another one I like. I get an awful charge out of that Sermon on the Mount. This guy was really loaded. Let's kick around a couple of these Moti equivalents of human philosophy on page 556, 13. Stars are best discerned from the lonely isolation of experiential depths, not from the illuminated and ecstatic mountaintops. That's true. If you go deep enough in a well, even in daytime, you can see the stars. Sometimes you have to get real low down in order to see real high up. This, to me, illuminates that statement. The greatest affliction in all the universe is never to have been afflicted. I love this too. difficulties may challenge mediocrity and defeat the fearful, but they only stimulate the true children of the Most High. Listen, you want to know something? I'm an awful lot like David Zebedee. I don't know whether I'd have thought so much of Jesus as a teacher in the boat shop at Capernaum, but maybe if he was a good mechanic, he would have made sense. But I take very literally what they say in these papers. When they say that before you get to Havona, you've learned to feast on uncertainty, to fatten on disappointment. I don't think this is any figure of speech. You remember what it was, Nathaniel or Thomas, when they were talking to Rodin, not long before Palm Sunday, when they talked about the future of Jesus. And one of them says, even now he speaks about his death, some mystical reference to his future glorification. You see, they were hearing. This is what Jesus meant when he says, he who has an ear to hear, let him hear. The words, the sound waves hit their ears, but they didn't register. I think they mean what they say when they say, feast on uncertainty, fatten on disappointment, invigorate in the presence of difficulties, exhibit indomitable courage when confronted with the inexplicable and immensity.
Will you discuss number 7?
Yeah. Blind and unforeseen accidents do not occur in the cosmos. In the largest sense of the word, there are no accidents. In the paper on the early evolution of religion, they make a very intriguing statement. They say, chance is a word which men use, which means they are either too ignorant or too indolent to find out why. If you could really figure out causation, you would eliminate the word chance. In the larger sense of the word, there are no accidents. But in detail, it also says, neither do the celestial beings assist the lower beings, the lower being who refuses to act upon his light of truth. The best illustration I know is one that we looked at today. Until the twins decided to flee, the life carriers couldn't help them. But when they did decide to flee, the life carriers told them which direction to go, because the twins had no Rand McNally Atlas. And it was very important they flee northward. Marvin.
Then the Calicastian Rebellion was not an accident.
As far as the first level of the firehouse is concerned, yes. On the higher levels, I'm not so sure. Probably not. Finitely, it was unpredictable. Superfinitely, when you go outside of time, Marvin, then you know the end from the beginning. But this has nothing to do with the free will choice of a human being in the stream of time. I'm sure that God knows in advance whether the Tennessee mountaineer is going to whip the bar or take a beating, but the mountaineer doesn't know, does he? And for that matter, neither does the bear.
That's right.
one of my favorites, there's several in here, to enjoy privilege without abuse, to have liberty without license, to possess power, and steadfastly refuse to use it for self-aggrandizement. These are the marks of high civilization. Incidentally, this is the principle which guided Jesus' 6 decisions out in the 40 days after the baptism. He had power, and he steadfastly refused to use it for self-aggrandizement. He used it a few times, but never for self-aggrandizement. In number 11, I love, the weak indulge in resolutions, but the strong act. Life is but a day's work. Do it well. The act is ours. The consequence is God's. And number 24, the destiny of eternity is determined moment by moment by the achievements of the day-by-day living. The acts of today are the destiny of tomorrow.
The decision
of
Andanapanta.
Why, yes.
Determine their destiny.
That's right.
And that decision, their daily act.
And here to me is the great principle of teaching, the greatest I have ever heard. The argumentative defense of any proposition is inversely proportional to the truth contained. Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." He did not say, "You shall know the facts, and the facts shall make you free." May I dip into my industrial experience a little bit? One of the biggest things I try to communicate to industrial management is the difference between fact and truth. It's what Jesus so magnificently demonstrated when he never answered the carpenter's question at Jaffa, "Do you think the big fish ever really did swallow Jonah?" He never descended to the level of fact, did he? I want to dramatize this difference, because this is a very tough thing to deal with. In general, I think, in planning your strategy, you better have your facts. But in executing your strategy at the level of tactics, you better deal with attitudes. And here's where truth is important. And fact and truth are quite different. As the papers say, facts don't change, but truth is ever changing. These are words. Let me illustrate. I spent a long time getting these two stories. And please, I'm dramatizing. And you've got to oversell your point to dramatize it. Can we have fact without truth? I offer this for your consideration. An extremely well-informed but unwise parent prematurely clobbers little Oswald, age 8, with the full, unexpurgated story of the birds and the bees, and seriously scars that child by this traumatic experience. This story could be exquisitely factual. I submit, it is not true. The child was damaged by these facts. I offer this as fact without truth. That one wasn't so tough, but I'm telling you, truth without fact took longer. But maybe this will suggest it to you. Please, I'm not trying to define. I'm trying to convey feeling. A junior in college, an anthropology major, went with his professor to the island of Borneo. And there, in an upland valley, spent the whole of the summer vacation with a Stone Age tribe. studying their language, their mores, their artifacts, their cultural level. And they left. 9 years later, this young man, now associate professor of anthropology in another university, headed a field expedition to the same upland valley, the same tribe. And the old chief was still alive and remembered him. And he looked at him and he said, "You big man, your tribe now." To which the associate professor replied, "Yes." "How many wives you have?" The unhesitating reply, "Six." "What cost these women?" Without the bat of an eyelash, the reply, 10 cows each." "You big man, your tribe." Truth without faith. If the professor had told the old chief, "I have one wife who cost me nothing," there would have been no communication whatsoever. Let's have a coffee break. Here's a suggested topic for some discussion. Instruction for teachers and believers. You are simply teaching friendship with God. I'd like to talk about this from two angles. One, my own personal experience, and two, some principles which I think are involved. First let me speak personally. For many, many years, it seemed to me, personally, that there were plenty of religious leaders who were in uniform. And what we needed was to wage a little guerrilla warfare. You know, we need to catch them on their blind side and bushwhack them. I remember a friend of mine who was a theological student, and years ago, more than I like to think, I was taking him to the train. He was going up to Minneapolis, and we'd had a nice weekend together, and on the way down to the station, and while we were parked, he really gave me the hard sell. I should listen to the call, you know, and I think above all things one should be polite. This guy was sincere and earnest and believed in this. And he thinks if you serve God, you've got to be a minister. Which is all right. With this, I'm not going to argue with him. I don't have to buy this, though. We all threw, and he had put in the rousements and asked for the order and everything else. And I let a little decent time elapse, and I turned to him and I said, "Joe," I said, "you work your side of the street and I'll work mine." And I said, "I'm going to get a lot of customers that you're going to miss, because there's a lot of human beings in this world that are simply allergic to the clergy and the churches. But they're still God's children. And I can do business with them. And if any of them are church-minded, I'll send them across the street and you can take over from there on out." I am not recommending this course of action to any of you people. I am merely sharing my thinking and my feeling with you. I am a layman. I'm going to stay that way all my life. I would be uncomfortable in any other capacity. You follow me? As a layman and as a businessman, I'm in a lot more potent position to recommend religion than if I'm anything other than a layman. I'll never forget, we may have touched on this earlier this week, I'll never forget the old hard-boiled engineer that was all turned inside out. in his relationships with people. And I didn't think that anything I could offer him would work fast enough this side of prayer. This happened in my office on Michigan Avenue. And I said to him, I said, Joe, I think there's only one way you can get straightened out, and that's to pray. He says, Jesus H. Christ, what did you say? I said, pray. I'm not swearing, I'm quoting. This whole thing loses its flavor, you know. Well, he says, you mean, now I lay me down to sleep? He says, for Christ's sakes, he says, I haven't prayed since I was a kid. I said, that's all right. I said, you need some help. And I said, I think you ought to talk to the boss about some help. My God, he says, this from you. You see, I'm getting through to this guy. If my collar were turned around, I couldn't sell this fellow this bill of goods. But I'm a fairly hard-boiled business consultant. He wasn't looking for this in my office. Well, he says, how do you pray? I said, talk natural. Oh, no, he says, I couldn't talk to God that way. I said, why not? I said, talk to God like you talk to your foundry superintendent. He says, that way? I said, sure. I said, I don't think the Almighty cares what words you use. Well, he thought a minute. He says, well, could you kind of give me a start on this praying business? I said, sure. I said, here's the way I'd talk to God if I were you. I would say, dear boss, as you can see, I am in a hell of a fix. And I need help, and I need it goddamn fast. And what are you going to do about it? He says, you talk to God that way? I says, no, I don't, but that's the way you talk. And I talk to God natural. He said, I'll be damned, I'll take you up on it. I think we got an awful lot of churches in this world, and I think we got an awful lot of clergymen in this world. And I think we need some people that are offbeat. They're not in uniform. They can sneak up on unsuspecting, God-fearing people, God-hungry people, and bushwhack them, like I bushwhacked this character. I'll never forget, oh, cripes, Kenneth Strite down in Dallas. This is a good story. Clyde Bedell gave a book to a TV scriptwriter. And Clyde and I both happened to serve this account, and I know this character. And I think Clyde, all I did was shake my head and say, Clyde wasted $12. This guy just, well, he doesn't qualify on the first statement in the Sermon on the Mount, He isn't hungry. He thinks he's got it made. My prediction as to the fate of this Urantia book was quite accurate. I heard indirectly that he got a big blue book and it was a great big crock, you know? That's all he thought about it. But this book operated on a ricochet basis. There was a security salesman who saw the book on this fellow's coffee table, borrowed it, never has returned it, and has given out 4 or 5 books. And I met Kenny Strite in Dallas. We had dinner at the Twin Trees, he and his wife and I. And I remember in the course of the evening, he looked at me and shook his head. He says, you know, he says, you're the most improbable sort of a character to be involved in something like this. I think that's maybe right. Well, why not get some improbable characters involved in religion? Why do people have to be thin, emaciated, no active taste buds? They're on special diets, and they're all full of fear and prohibitions and taboos. Why not get some perfectly ordinary critters interested in the service of the kingdom of heaven? What's wrong with this idea?
Bill, then you become a minister, whether you, there's a difference there.
You're damn right you do. And even in Christianity, any Christian can be a minister to his fellow men. Yes, in that sense, small m, I am a minister. You're quite right. and proud to be. You know a word I like better? Server.
Well,
that's a much better word.
Well, only because of the connection the ministry might have, I think it's a very fine word.
I'd like to call your attention to an interesting statement in the papers. We're told something about the evolution of civilization on a neighboring planet. And in many ways, they have progressed farther than we have. But there is one institution that we have which has never appeared on this planet, and that is a church. This planet doesn't have a single church on it. And I would raise a question. Is a church a necessary part of civilization? I ask the question. I offer no answer whatsoever. Yes?
I'm just going to say not to them, but obviously it's necessary to us or it wouldn't exist.
It's happened on this world.
Doesn't mean it's necessary.
Marvin, we really got one going now.
It might be that it's a means to an end. Plus the fact that there is a possibility that the churches might devolve.
Right. Murray?
Well, I was going to point out that in the Jesus papers, Jesus keeps saying that religion is a personal experience and has no, there's no need for ritual and dogma and buildings and places to go and
right.
to pray. You can pray within your own heart and you don't need any edifice whatsoever.
That's right. Anybody else have ideas? How are they working on this neighboring planet? They have temples of philosophy, where I suspect they explore philosophy, theology. They discuss what they believe. This week is not a religious week. It's an intellectual week. We're exploring and we're trying to explore this book. If there is a religious aspect to this week, it's not a group thing, it's an individual thing. It's in your own heart. On a neighboring planet, religion takes place in the home. The only social repercussions are recognized as clearly intellectual, and they're collective. I don't think that will take place on this world. We have the church institution. I merely call your attention to the fact that churches apparently are not an inevitability in the evolution of society.
Can I ask you a question, Bill?
You sure can. I don't think they'll have a sports page on the mansion world, but otherwise it'll be fine.
No golf courses.
Not so sure about that.
Just for the fun of it, by one magic stroke, wham, all the churches are gone.
Yes.
So
I think we'd have a void that would be irreplaceable.
Huh?
I think we'd have a void that couldn't be filled. They're needed in our present level of civilization. Very needed. Question.
Do you think that eventually they will evolve to temples of philosophy? Because they very rarely, you know, in the Protestant churches even hit on very much religion anymore, per se.
I know. I don't know, Pat. I don't know. I so wish they would that I'm afraid my objective appraisal isn't reliable.
Well, possibly that could happen in the Protestant
yes.
line, but my feeling would be it couldn't happen in the Catholicism because that is a different
exactly.
track entirely.
Let's hope. Let's hope in the Protestant line, Helena.
The difference between the Greek temples of philosophy and the ones you're talking about, what would that be?
The Greek temples of philosophy were not related to a living religion as such. It was a more formal state religion. The living religion in Greece was the mystery cults, and these were not related to the schools of philosophy. There was a divorcement of religion and philosophy in Greece. Apparently, on a neighboring planet, they are related. Marvin?
Well, I was just going to say that when Betty and I were first married, when we went over to Manistee for our summer vacation, for a long time we felt sort of obligated to go to church because Betty's mother was probably the most devout Episcopalian, bigoted Episcopalian I've ever met. And the preacher at that particular time was an old goat. And you could go into the church, you had the music and so forth, but when you walked out, I would tell Betty's mother, I feel like a dog. You felt like that no matter what you did, that anything good would come out. I don't know, I can't express it exactly, but that's the way I felt. And after a while, I had enough nerve to refuse to go except on
Easter
or on...
Well, that was old school hell and damnation.
Yeah.
Later, they had another minister that I used to drink a little wine with, and I sort of enjoyed going over to the listening to his service.
Marvin is what we call a wine Christian.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the basic difference in the Greek philosophy that man descended from the gods rather than in Christianity that he descended from, like, an ascending rather
than
descending?
That's Greek mythology.
Oh.
Greek philosophy presented several different schools of thought and impinged on a rarefied monotheism, which had very little appeal to the common people. The Greeks offered basically three schools of thought. Stoicism, which is heroic self-respect, a dedication to duty for the very simple reason that you are the kind of person who is dedicated to duty. Epicureanism says, in essence, enjoy this life intelligently. Have intelligence. The pursuit of happiness is an Epicurean ideal. Epicureanism can degenerate into hedonism, which is sensualism. You know, enjoy your senses. This is rather gross. The third school of philosophy was skepticism, which says since you can't really be sure, you can't know anything. Now, the Greek philosophy at its highest impinged on monotheism. But it was a pretty abstract God. It was not a loving father, and it had no appeal to the masses. The thing that appealed to the Greek masses were the Eleusinian mysteries, for one, which is the passion enactment of the death of summer and the rebirth of spring, the worship of Demeter. And of course, then you have Marvin's patron saint, Dionysius, and the worship of the grape. And it's very, very interesting byproduct.
I'm going to end up here as being an old alcoholic.
Well, Marvin and I have said a few masses to Dionysius.
Yes. Will people be able to get a jug on the match, you were?
This is something that's got Tackett really sweating.
Well,
yes,
Elena. Did you say that the Greeks that you thought had come from a non-spiritual thought
race? Yeah, or at least it was attenuated.
Yes. And what about this mystery cult? Was it religious at all?
Yes, it was religious. It was an attempt to achieve salvation by going through a rite.
But it had no spiritual significance.
How do you know? That would depend on how people reacted to it. The same would apply to Mithraism. Here, we have the symbolic concept of the blood of the Lamb in Christianity.
I don't know what that means.
Well, here, let me give you some instruction in Orthodox Christianity. Adam sinned. And because Adam sinned, God is mad. And because God is mad, everybody is damned. And everybody stays damned until God's Son, because he loves us, incidentally, where the hell did he get this love? That he should love us more than God. He says, I will square it with the old man. I will come down and die for mankind. And so he does. And finally, when God sees his blameless son dying on the cross of Calvary, at last God's flinty, stony heart is touched. And he says to his son, "All right, I'll give the boys that are with you a break." And so, since Jesus is the sacrificial lamb, if you have been washed in the blood of the lamb, you can make it. Otherwise, down with you. Pardon my street language, but you communicate more clearly that way. Also, it sounds more horrible that way. In Mithraism, you were washed in the blood of the bull. And the Mithraists were a little more literal. You went through a ceremony called the Tarabolium. Quite expensive. You buy your vestments, and they have a scaffolding. And you walk under, and they leave this bull up on top. And you stand underneath there in a very holy attitude. And look, again, this is a symbol. Let's not be too darn sure that some people didn't make spiritual progress in the middle of this ridiculous transaction. And they cut the throat of the bull, and you're drenched in the blood of the bull. And you save your blood-stained vestments, and you're buried in them.
Is that where Christianity got the blood of the lamb?
It could have been. Mithraism is older than Christianity. Spiritual progress in the middle of this ridiculous transaction. Yes, Marie.
Much further back than that.
Well, could it be that this blood of the lamb...
You save your blood-stained vestments and you're buried in them.
They sacrificed...
Is that where Christianity got the blood of the lamb?
The lamb was sacrificed, so when Jesus came...
That's Paul's adaptation. Sure. That's Paul's adaptation. But the sacrifice
of
being washed in blood was not unique in the Hebrew religion. The Mithraists said it too. If you're going to teach this book, I think the first thing you should do is to do what comes naturally. I don't think that Jesus, with all his great powers of persuasion and education, could have made an orator out of Andrew. Andrew had no aptitude for oratory, did he? Andrew was a darn good organizer and had a keen nose for human abilities. How were the 12 organized? Jesus picked the best organizer in the 12 and told him to organize the 12, merely making a request, "I'd like to have two or three of your brethren to be with me." And from there on out, the 12 were organized in accordance with Andrew's decision. Peter was an orator. Matthew and James were darn good speakers. They could preach. Philip was a good personal worker. When Rodin, the Greek philosopher, showed up, did Jesus pick Peter the preacher and Simon Zelotes the patriot to talk to Rodin? No, not at all. He picked Thomas the scientist and Nathaniel the philosopher to talk to Rodin. Did he say to the Alpheus twins, when he talked to them two by two on the shores of Galilee that last time, did he say to James and Judas Alpheus, "Will you be good shepherds? Will you feed my sheep?" Not at all. He sent them back to their fishnets. He asked Peter to be a good shepherd. Number one, in teaching this book, in transmitting this book, first of all, do what comes natural to you. This is more convincing. This does not mean that you have to remain the present, unvarnished you. There are two ways I would like to symbolize of growth. Well, one really is swelling, the other is growth. Let's consider a piece of lumber, good lumber. Don't enamel it. This is false. Instead of that, sand it, polish it. Bring the grain of your wood to the most exquisite level of polish attainable to you. This is legitimate. Be your true self, but be your finest self. If you're an orator, try oratory. If you're Philip, be a good personal worker. Philip made capital out of his lack of imagination. Philip lacked the imagination to tell people to go do that, this, and go do that. Hence, he was the best trainer that you could have, because Philip did it the only way Philip could do it. He took him by the hand and he says, "Come on, I'll show you how." This is good teaching. If you're a philosopher, fine, philosophize. But I don't think Peter would ever made a very good philosopher, do you? That was Nathaniel's forte. If you're an organizer, emulate Andrew. Organize things. But maybe you're not an organizer. Maybe you're a doer. Then do things. First of all, be yourself if you want to be a teacher. Listen, I know a lot of fancy words. I think I could even counterfeit a holy tone if I could keep myself from developing nausea. But that wouldn't be me, and it wouldn't be convincing, would it? I'm a businessman. I'm not a holy Joe. And I come before you as a pretty practical man of the world who happens to know about this book. And that's all I'm trying to be, is myself talking to you. Isn't it more convincing? This is me. I'm not too proud of the polish I have on the grain. I'm still working at it, but Lord, you should have seen the splinters that were there 20 years ago. You know what I mean? Be yourself. Work to become a better version of your true self. That's the first suggestion I offer you. My Lord, this guy, Pat knows him, B.M. Salyer, gets away with stuff that I would fall on my face on. But you want to know something? I don't think that Sandy Wall would ever give B.M. Salyer the time of day. He's my pigeon. And isn't it nice that we're different? Because we can cope with different types of people. The 12 apostles were entirely different, weren't they? Number two. You don't have to be frenzied. With the possible exception of Marvin, we are snatching no brands from the burning. You know? You got a good devout Buddhist. If the guy is sincere, just because he calls God Amitabha, does that excite you particularly? No. If he's making progress and trying to love his fellow man, well, as one Buddhist abbot told James Bissett Pratt, or a monk I guess he was, he says, as I observe the better Christians, he says, they're all Buddhists without realizing it. Leave the frenzy out of your approach. Years ago, I finished my study of foreign religions and got down to the study of the Bible. This is the last sacred book I read. Well, you see, I figured everybody else in the Chicago Forum were hep on the Bible, but they didn't know about this other stuff. So I finally got around to studying Christianity, very interesting study to make against the background of non-Christian religions, many of which were older than Christianity. You can see the impact they had on Christianity. Jesus most touchingly challenged his followers not only to believe what he believed, but also to believe as he believed. This is the full significance of his one supreme requirement: follow me. Jesus' earthly life was devoted to one great purpose: doing the Father's will, living the human life religiously and by faith. The faith of Jesus was trusting, like that of a child, but it was wholly free from presumption. He made robust and manly decisions, courageously faced manifold disappointments, resolutely surmounted extraordinary difficulties, and unflinchingly confronted the stern requirements of duty. It required a strong will and an unfailing confidence to believe what Jesus believed and as he believed. I think one of the contributions which the Urantia book may make to the evolution of religion on Urantia is the figurative resurrection of the human Jesus from the theological tomb of 19 centuries. We've talked about teaching this book, and we've talked about how to do it and that sort of thing. Let's talk a little bit, in closing, about how we teach religion to children. Fred's very interested in Sunday school teachers. Very sound. I've had some experience teaching Sunday school in one church or another. You know, while I'm completely innocent of church discipline, I'm not unacquainted with churches. I teach in such places. I think we can best present religion to children by presenting Jesus as a hero. Children want heroes. Adults do too, for that matter. I have a tremendous admiration for the human Jesus. Just the human Jesus, Joshua ben Joseph. I think he was a perfectly splendid human being. He had lots of courage and lots of kindness. He had great strength. And his strength was so beautifully controlled that it made of him a most gracious person. He was one of the most consecrated and sincere and unstuffy people who ever lived. He always had time out for people. I've had fun trying to get kids excited about the human Jesus in different Sunday school groups that I've talked to. Over the years, it's added up to quite a number. Of course, I can only talk about the Bible. But even in the scriptures, you can tell some interesting stories. Consider what he did on Palm Sunday. This story I've told to kids. I've had him sitting on the edge of the seat. Here he is. It's Sunday morning. It's the last week he's going to be around. And he wants to broadcast this message. And here in Jerusalem are all these multitudes assembled. All the faithful have come in to celebrate the Passover. From the far west and the far east and the north and the south, the dispersion has ingathered for this holy day. If he can talk to this multitude, he can broadcast in the only way you could broadcast in the first century AD. But there's a kind of an odd cross between a board of aldermen, a senate of the commonwealth, and the college of cardinals called the Sanhedrin, which is determined that he's going to die. And here he sits in Bethany scratching his head. How do you get into the city and broadcast? If I were an AP dispatch writer, I know the headline that I'd string across every column in the paper. One man against the city. And he has already decided that he will not use any powers other than human to further himself. He's got to sit down and figure out how to crack this nut using purely human resources. And you all know what he did. He almost raised a riot. He was an expert in symbolism. He entered Jerusalem riding on a donkey, which is symbolic of the arrival of a man on a mission of peace. A warrior came on horseback. We still have the expression, man on horseback. The news got spread. The multitude came out. It was a terrific outpouring of popular enthusiasm. And this local board of aldermen sat in their rock-hewn chamber near the temple, where their knees rattling together like Spanish castanets. He just scared the living daylights out of them, and they were afraid to touch him for more than 3 days. And he broadcast in peace. This, to me, is a triumph of human ingenuity. What other man do you know of who entered a city, a walled city, against the defiance of all the civil authorities and taught unmolested for 3 days? This is exciting.